The internet loves kittens, so...
They do.
Yeah, absolutely. Let that happen. That's not a problem.
I know. I should probably put catnip on myself or tuna soup.
I've never tried that. You know, it depends on the cat. That can be really terrifying.
That's true. I might get just eaten alive.
Yeah, cats, they really vary how they respond to catnip, in my experience. Hey everyone, it is June 9th, 2019, and this is your episode 183 of Epercussion. My name is Casey Cangelosi, and with me is my co-host, Carly Vigna. Hey, Carly.
Hi, everyone.
And filling in for Ben Charles today is our other co-host, Tracy Wiggins. How's it going?
It's going well.
You guys, I have to apologize. I'm a little under the weather. My kid made me sick, I assume, from daycare. Is this how it goes, Tracy? Do I have many more years of this to look forward to?
Absolutely.
Like, does it ever get better? I think Robin's gotten me sick, specifically from daycare.
Yeah, all of the plagues go through daycare.
Well, everyone, you've heard from our guest already. With us today is the principal percussionist of the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. She's also been the principal percussionist for the San Diego Symphony Orchestra, and she teaches at DePaul University as well as the Aspen Music Festival, and of course has done a lot of other great and wonderful things. So please welcome to the show, Cynthia Yeh. How's it going?
It's good. Going well.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, you're very welcome. Are you coming from Chicago today? Are you home?
I am home at the moment, yes.
And it must feel really amazing to be back to work. For those of you who don't know, the Chicago Symphony had a strike recently.
We did. We had a 7-week strike. So it does feel good to be back. We're all very glad that it's over.
Oh yeah, I can only imagine. And of course, you know, please only share with us what you're able to and allowed. But you were actually there's a Facebook question about this. I'm gonna ask that, and it's from our friend Will Marinelli. Will, thanks for always giving us good questions. Will asks, can you please talk about your work in resolving the recent strike as part of the CSO's Musicians Negotiating Committee?
Well, this was my lucky year to be on the negotiating team. So it's my first time on the negotiating team, and well, you know, the orchestra went out for 7 weeks, so I don't know that I'll ever get asked back to do it, but it was an interesting process, as in just I had never seen how the contracts that we have now got negotiated. Like the whole process of it, all the whole behind the scene thing about it. And yeah, it's a steep learning curve. I mean, it took us more than a year from the first time we actually sat down with the other side, more than a year's worth of meetings the mayor had to step in and he kind of made us just come to an agreement that day. It was kind of a thing of, okay, you guys, this is enough. Enough is enough.
Yeah, sure. Well, I mean, it's so outside of our expertise. You know, you said this learning curve. What was your involvement? Like, what did you have to do or help with or facilitate?
Well, the negotiating process itself was just like, you know, we all have, you know, every orchestra has like a CBA they have with their management, and it's like a book, you know, that's like that thick. Well, I never ever cracked it open. I just assume someone in the orchestra knows the ins and outs of the details of the contracts, but it's just you kind of enter an orchestra as a player and you're told that you have this contract and you kind of just go along with it because you've never had to crack open that contract to know that, like, if you've been traveling X number of days, you get X number of days off, that, you know, if you play a Sunday concert, preceded by a previous blah blah concert, it can't be followed by a blah blah service. Like, all these details like had to actually get worked out by our predecessors, and had no idea that I had no appreciation for it. I had no understanding of it. It just kind of was like, well, of course you wouldn't have that service. And it never quite like put the two and two together how it came about. And that was with like blood, sweat, and tears of, you know, all those who came before us. So that was like the negotiating part of just like learning language, dealing with lawyers and dealing with actuaries and sitting through like pension presentation after pension presentation. Mm. And kind of how the rest of the world works at work jobs.
Yeah.
You know, like I don't know. And then there was then there was like when we actually did go out on strike, and of course I definitely didn't have any experience with that, you know, like dealing with our own colleagues. And you know, we put on a lot of free concerts for the city, and putting on a concert, I know like many of you guys have probably put on concerts, whereas us orchestral players, like, we don't put on concerts. The management puts on concerts. We just go and play concerts. So to actually have to put on a concert was like that took like a little bit of a learning curve, like things you take for granted. And the fact that, oh crap, we don't have a stage crew. What do you mean you don't have a stage crew? Well, crap, how do you even set up a stage?
Right.
That, like, I kind of had to dig back and figure that out.
I was going to ask, what was the first piece you played when after the strike ended, and what did that feel like? Like, did it feel different? Did it feel extra good or something?
Yeah. So, you know, believe it or not, I'm going to have to look up what that piece is. Well, so we did put on concerts like during the strike, right. That many of them did not have percussion just because it was easier and this venue was smaller and we didn't have to rent stuff. I know that the first week back was a Muti week at the end of April. No, May.
This reminds me of Jason Haheim's episode, the timpanist of the Met. And he, we're asking him, so what's on tap for this week? What are you playing? And he said, I don't know. He had to like look it up, what he was playing. And
oh, that's what it is. Pines of Rome.
Oh, great.
And then a bunch of stuff that there was no percussion, but the only thing I played on. So it was like, the program was Muti conducting a piece from Bizet called Roma, and then Berlioz, The Death of Cleopatra. Joyce DiDonato was the soloist for that, and then ended with Pines of Rome.
Wow, very cool. Yeah, that must have been great. So, Carly, I think you have a little follow-up question from our buddy Jade Hales.
I do, yeah. Jade Hales was writing also about the strike, and one of the questions was, Cynthia, what do you think students can do now while they're in school to prepare to enter an environment that seems to be increasingly uncooperative towards fair pay and benefits?
Well, I think part of what I learned through the process and just seeing, you know, because we negotiate with management, but who answers to the board. And I think part of it is kind of like, you know, arts, it's something that's kind of like not tangible, and it doesn't, there are no numbers attached to arts other than like a negative cash flow. So, but the thing is, what arts gives people is something that is unexplainable. You can't touch it, but it gives us, the listeners, something, an experience, right? So we're in the business of that. And so it's, I don't know, I would imagine that for students today, it's about making sure that everyone around them understands that, like the culture of what the arts is about is kind of spread throughout society, because we tend to forget, or because of social media and like the readiness, quickness, and of just the way the world works now, no one stops and just sits back and listen. And that is something that we, if we don't cultivate ourselves, is hopefully we'll never get lost, because someone will always appreciate it. But like, to, it's been on, I don't want to say that it's been on the decline, but at the same time, it's not brought to the foreground. So I think maybe if you're a young student, if you're going out to concerts, it's also reaching out to the audiences in that way of like making them aware of this experience, and not trying to always like, I don't want to say like dumb down the experience for them, but at the same time, reach out that we are aware that, you know, the world is changing, but at the same time, the moments that you to put value to those moments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the tricky thing a lot of times. I mean, and I think in society as a whole, to value the arts and even educationally to put a value to, you know, the learning in the arts. And we have all these different types of assessment that we have to do. And of course we do. But yeah, it's tricky. Numbers are tricky for us. And what is our value? And of course, we all see the value. That's why we're here. And our listeners, I'm sure also. But that's, yeah, I think you hit that nail on the head. That's the tricky part.
Yeah, it's a tricky part. And somehow if we can have this whole movement of just like whenever we do go out to engage with the audience, instead of it being an us and them, like instead of being, you know, you're the performer on stage after you play, you're out. And so they see you as like a thing that is not quite relatable. Whereas we're still human beings that just happen to play an instrument. To make it maybe a lot more personal could maybe help with that.
Yeah, I agree.
I like this topic a lot, and I think it has to do with teaching two sections of music appreciation for 6 years out in the middle of nowhere, West Virginia, which I really enjoyed and am still really passionate about. But I really like giving a talk in a clinic and basing this whole class on the idea that, hey, entertainment doesn't come first in the fine arts, at least. Sometimes it does. You know, there's plenty of art music that is just total candy, of course. But I try to do a whole series of exercises with them to try to say, like, hey, this isn't just about being entertained. That's not what is first and foremost. It's deeper than that. It's supposed to hopefully give you something to think about. I mean, a minimalist artwork by Blinky Palermo, that's just a square and another square. Yeah, that's not really meant to entertain you. It's meant to make you think, or you know what I mean? It's like we really know this about art, and unfortunately to get those deeper messages, yeah, it takes like your full attention and to sit all the way through Mahler 6 and see Cynthia play the hammer blows, which I saw somewhere on YouTube. You have a hammer blow on YouTube, which is pretty cool.
Well, I guess twice, but yes.
Well, two or three, that's the big question. Is your version two?
I've never played the third because I think no one's ever wanted to tempt fate.
Yeah. So those of you who don't know, there's like, I think the first smaller version was three hammer blows and the resting version is two, I guess. But yeah, cool.
I guess, but the other thing that I get asked a lot is, you know, but I don't understand classical music, or, you know, I don't, what the etiquette, or, you know, what if I just don't understand it? And I mean, my answer has always been like, there is no right or wrong way to listen. Like, yeah, no one's judging you. Trust me, there's a lot of music I don't understand. And I just sit, I either just play it the best I can because it's way above me, or, you know, something, you know, whether it's a taste thing or like purely understanding thing. But there isn't really a wrong way to it, because it's supposed to like trigger a thought and a feeling, right? Mostly. So then you can't take away someone's feeling. Like, it can be a feeling of confusion, could be the thought you're supposed to have anyways.
Yeah.
So then to be scared by it and to be intimidated by it is kind of like, I think that's where we don't seem approachable, both as performers and as an art form. Whereas, you know, we are still humans and we're not any smarter than anybody else. It's just, I don't know, just listen to it. It doesn't matter.
I've heard a lot of people say that too. So yeah, somewhere we screwed that up or they screwed that up for us. And now we're paying the price.
Yeah.
Yeah, where they feel intimidated or like, do I clap? I'm so nervous to, you know.
Right, and you don't want to be shushed. And then, but I mean, at the same time, like, our music director at Muti is like 78, 79, and old school European. Like, if you clap in the wrong spot, you get a glare. And
yeah.
But I think the clap isn't for him being pissed at you not understanding. It's the glare is for you interrupting the train of thought.
Yep, I get that.
Yeah. You know, and just kind of messing with the moment, mm-hmm. which I think at the same time probably also means you were sitting there wondering when to clap. And as soon as it's over, you start clapping because that's the thing you're supposed to do instead of just letting it wash over you. Because if it did wash over you, you wouldn't probably be clapping. Mm. Right? But I know.
Yeah. Tracy?
Yeah, so I had a question kind of following up what we were talking about as far as the, you know, listening and things like that. I know that I run into this a lot with my students, that the open-mindedness of students a lot of times is not really very existent, and that they want to listen to what they like and what they know, and they're not totally open to listening to that which is unusual to them. And you kind of brought that up in the context a little bit of audiences and stuff, but how do you deal with that in students also?
Don't you just make them play it? I think that's the whole point of schooling. Like, you don't really get that much of a choice. I guess for me, like, so like Doug Perkins is a good friend, and we've had this discussion where I'm not a minimalist person. He calls me, I'm a harmony person. So like, you know, like Steve Reich, would I choose to listen to it on my own? Would that be a piece where I choose to just, oh, I really, really want to play that piece? But I do it anyway, so it's like taking your vitamins. Mm-hmm. You just kind of have to take your vitamins. I mean, I take a lot of vitamins. Because, or else you don't grow as a human. And it's like, there's, I mean, isn't that why we do what we do? So that we're in the world of, like, if you just kind of get in your bubble, and if I would tell this to a student, like, how are you supposed to grow as a human being and as a musician if you're constantly sheltered? Mm-hmm. And it can't hurt you. It would only challenge you. And if you, like, meet a challenge, usually that makes you a, whether you know it or not, makes you a better musician somewhere down the road. And you can't know when that is, but you'll be shocked at, like, when something comes up and you're like, oh yeah, it's not so scary anymore. Yeah, I got it.
What's that concept of acquired taste? You know, you hope you can give it to them at such a pace that it becomes their own acquired taste. But yeah, of course, I agree. Like, hey, you got to play this. This is what we're working on. And here you go. You know, and like I mentioned with the class, like, set aside whether this entertains you or you like it. That's not the first and foremost, most important thing, especially for you, the person sitting in the class, or you, the person sitting behind the instrument.
Yeah. And I mean, like, I guess I've somehow, because of my piano background, I was in, like, Bach, Beethoven, Mozart, like, even Scriabin was, like, a little too far out. Bartok, way out.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, well, what? How is that possible? You know, like, just the fact that you can expand and there is beauty in everything. Make them. It's vitamins.
Well, yeah. Cynthia, it's funny you mentioned Steve Reich, because for me, that was when I knew a lot of people love those pieces, and I just didn't get it, but I'm sure it's valuable. And so I played some Steve Reich even, and it was until, like, I had one experience in the audience of hearing music for 18 musicians, and I was like, wow, I get it all of a sudden. So I'm wondering, is there any composer, any style of music or genre or anything that for you, like, you felt like, I'm not sure if I get this, like, I'm not sure if I like this, and then all of a sudden it kind of made sense?
Well, okay, going back to Steve Reich, like, the whole phasing thing, and then it goes out of phase and it comes back in, and the, like, I guess I don't find it as, maybe I mean, those who know me know I'm not really a romantic, but maybe I actually really am at heart in terms of, like, harmony and, like, that sort of resolution or that sort of starkness. I'm just trying to think if there's anything that where I, like, totally didn't get and now I think I get it. Well, first of all, I'm not sure that I get anything for that matter. So then I I know this will sound like really geeky talking to you guys, but like I didn't used to get Stravinsky. I used to just, it just sounded so cacophonous, but like that's just how old school I am. But now it's, he wrote some of the most beautiful stuff. But
I don't get Mendelssohn and I don't get Berlioz. I know they're nothing alike, but that's just how it's always been.
Anyone else have any confessions?
Yeah, that was a confession. I was expecting to get stricken down.
Well, I mean, no, I'm just trying to think back. Well, I guess with Mendelssohn, there isn't that much with percussion, so there's not for a whole lot for me to have to sit through and try to understand. There's like definitely pieces where I don't understand why we keep playing it or why it's such a masterwork because it's so cheesy. But that's a taste thing.
I want more confessions, Carly. Cynthia Tracy.
My husband and I were just talking earlier this week about Strauss, the tone poems, and how sometimes it's cacophonous. Like you said, there's just so much going on and what's important. And, you know, it's kind of funny. Some of these pieces are like so standard in our repertoire, but we were just talking about that. Like, yeah, it's hard to know what you're listening to sometimes.
Oh, those tone poems are cool. Okay, that was, that was,
they're cool.
Okay, that was wrong, Tracy.
Okay, here's my confession. The only early music I'm even remotely interested in is Bach.
Also wrong. Okay.
This is good. This, well, that's a bad one to be remotely interested in.
Yeah, but my wife and I argue about this all the time because she's really interested. She teaches elementary music and things, but she's really into like early music and recorder and everything. And I have, she turns that on and I just want to run to the other side of the house.
With, there's recorder, like recorders.
Yeah.
That one, I agree.
Wait, what about like Josquin and Lassus, like even before?
Yeah.
Nope. Bet I can sell you on it. Hey, well, let's move on. Tracy, I think you have a cool question from our dear friend and past guest, Julie Spencer, right?
Yes, Julie says for Cynthia, how do you internalize your own sense of meaning in an orchestral work, collaborating with the conductor, section, and the whole ensemble versus as a soloist?
Hmm. Well, I feel like orchestral players kind of get their wings clipped a long time ago, right? So we, I mean, I guess I still play a phrase I would, like a conductor is not gonna, luckily I haven't had too many conductors who micromanage how I would personally play a phrase, right? So, or how I would personally, this gets really nerdy, but like how I would personally hear the attack of a certain cymbal crash. Like no one really micromanages that too much in at my orchestra. So I do still feel like I do get to put my own two cents in, as in this is how I want to play it. And by saying that I got my wings clipped in that, to me, there is a style in which, like, you know, Strauss will get played, that Mahler will get played, that Verdi will get played, that Mozart will get played. That's the range I work with and that I have choice in how I want to do it. And I pick a different style, sound, articulation, mallet, phrasing, whatever. Those are still all my choices. They might, you know, sometimes they'll ask for something different. Sometimes they'll ask for something really way out there. And you kind of reluctantly do it. And those are like the wing clipping weeks. But the conductors that, you know, we really love and respect, it kind of goes both ways. So they respect us to make these choices. And most of them just leave us alone. So I don't feel like, you know, it's not a solo as in I don't get to play. Well, no, see, because we're one and apart, we do still get to play soloistically. So, yeah, I don't feel too, like, restricted.
Very cool. I watched just earlier today the CSO's video recording of Jupiter from the planets, and you were on Glock. Of course, Dave Herbert's on Timpani. Vadim was on, I guess, Timpani 2. And you have such an amazing section. And I was just going to ask, is there, I don't know, like, we have a question from Facebook asking about how you manage the section and what that's like, and especially as a female, but we can get to that. I was just wondering, like, all those individuals, James Ross, Dave Herbert, Vadim, Patsy Dash, what do they each bring? Like, what have you learned from each of them that's maybe like on an individual level?
We actually all get along really well. So it's, and we all have our strengths and weaknesses. So, I mean, as principal, I kind of assign parts the way so that we're all really comfortable playing what we're playing.
Sure.
And like certain likes and dislikes, like I like playing bass drum cymbal. Like if I'm playing bass drum or cymbals, if I'm playing cymbals, I like Jim on bass drum. He's like my sidekick. We any time, like if Muti's in town and takes two, it's Jim and I. It's just like, he's like my buddy. I don't know how that happened, but like somehow I gravitated. We just kind of got along. We get along great. So he's my buddy. So we're tight. With David, we rarely have to talk. If I'm on bass drum, he's on timps. We rarely have to talk about placement. We just feel things the same way. We hear things, I think, pretty much the same way. So it's just this unwritten thing. Occasionally, we'll like, one time it'll be like, I'm early, he's late. And then next time we'll both have adjusted to each other. And then now I'm late and he's early. And then we might have to talk about it, like meet somewhere in the middle. So yeah, it's just, I don't know. And I mean, I am I guess David's newer than me, but when I joined the orchestra section, I guess within the percussion section, I'm still the newest member. So there's also like tradition of, you know, some people, because like Patsy took over Sam Denoff's spot, and Sam Denoff was the cymbal player in the CSO for years and years and years. So she took over a lot of the cymbal parts in like a lot of the Mahler symphonies and Strauss stuff. Like, yeah, there's just like standard pieces depending on who retired. You kind of just take over the spot, but yeah.
It's so interesting to me, and it's such an appealing idea, like to play with the same people regularly on a regular basis. Because of course, yeah, Carly, Tracy, and I were all at universities, and of course we play with people all the time. But yeah, it's like, man, in 4 years, I've probably only played with the same people 3 or 4 times. You know, and it's based off over years. The same faculty, of course, we interact with our students a ton. But it'd be so cool musically to play that often, reoccurring. It's one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast. Like, you know, of course we all travel the world and we all meet people and we all do our gigs and things, but it's really cool to keep coming back to see the same people. Like, you learn so much more when you don't have to start back at step one with someone. That's always been such an appealing idea about a symphony and being in a section for years.
It's actually the rest of my orchestra that I get more like, I get so used to them. I have no idea until I'm like at a festival in the summer or playing extra, like, because we were on strike. I played a week out in San Francisco and a week out in Atlanta. And it was just the rep out in San Francisco was Scheherazade, and we had just toured of Scheherazade with Muti. And so it was just like the things you get used to is amazing, because I've known our principal clarinet for X number of years. And you know, I just know what he's going to do. I know how the flute player is going to play. I know how our concertmaster is going to play. Like, I pretty much just know how everyone's going to play and what I expect. And when you go somewhere else with the same rep, it's like a very, very bizarre experience to me. Not like bad, but just different. And it's just like, well, that's not quite the sound I'm used to.
Yeah. Yeah, I understand. Yeah. Hey, so we have a Facebook question that I think follows some of these lines, and it's from, I'm so sorry if I mispronounce your name, from Christella Naim. And she says, great to hear from such a wonderful percussionist, such a good example for all of us. I'm a classically trained percussionist from Lebanon, and we have a good level of classical music for our country in the Middle East. However, sometimes people in my field don't understand or support the fact that I'm a female playing percussion, especially classical, for many reasons. Lack of information about our training as percussionists and how far can one go as a performer. The culture and the fact that globally females might be seen as less competent. So here's my question. What has been a challenge for you as a female percussionist and leader? Also, what is something that helped you face those challenges in your career? And what would be your advice for an ambitious female percussionist? And she says, with much respect, and says, there are challenges everywhere.
Wow, that's a lot of questions.
I know.
I guess, I don't know. Maybe it's because the way I was raised, my mom, I was a tomboy. All my cousins were boys. My mom never well, she did and she didn't, but I never really thought of myself as like a girl, like as in a girl that's different from a boy, as in there should be different things that we can do. So I guess I was always raised like you could do whatever you want, but whatever it is, you just have to do it better than everybody else. So it was the idea of doing it better was way more important to me than whether I'm a girl or a guy. So I get asked that like in the States quite a bit by female students when I do a class or something or at festivals. And I feel like my answer has always been just play better than them. Mm-hmm. Don't give anyone an excuse for why you didn't get picked. Be that much better. Be that much more prepared and just be better. That's it, to a point where they can't argue it. And you know, sometimes once in a while it might get argued, but then keep at it and just keep beating them. You're not, like, I guess I was also raised to not really have an excuses. Like there's no, it sounds bad, but I am Asian. There's no excuse for failure. It's because you didn't work hard enough. You know, and like to blame some other reason is like, is not something I've really done. So if, you know, I took many auditions and I was runner up a lot and in the finals a lot, and did I ever say, well, it must have been because I was a girl. No, it was always because I messed them up. It was always because, well, yeah, you kind of didn't know when to muffle in Brahms. On the triangle, you kind of did not prepare that. That was why I thought I lost it. It was never going to be like, oh, well, it must have been because I was a girl. Like, I don't use it as an excuse. But then again, I've always kind of, well, okay, so I was born in Taiwan, but I was pretty much raised in North America, where I guess women have had more opportunities. Yeah. Does that answer her question? But then I've never been to the Middle East, so I don't know if that's, I mean, I guess my only advice I could give her is just be better.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. And geez, all I would add for Christella is, sorry. It is tough for you where you are. And there are a lot of us in other places really rooting for you and, you know, could care less whether you're a boy, a girl or what, and just, want to hear you play.
Yeah.
It reminds me of, I met a friend recently, Kay Hashimoto Reed. I met her at Bill Shaltis's gig, Memphis, Tennessee, and she's from Japan. She talks about, her love is timpani. And I don't think she'd mind sharing this. She shared it openly with everyone there and in a class. So I don't think she'd mind, but, how there were just, she thought she played timpani very, very, very well. And that there was so much adversity to, well, you're a female and usually females aren't timpanists. So it wasn't like, hey, you're playing bad. It was just like, that's just usually not what we see. sorry, and she met all this resistance that had nothing to do with her playing. but of course, she's a timpanist now, and it's doing wonderfully. But yeah, what a tough issue.
Like, if you consistently do better than someone, then all these people, at some point, someone is going to kind of say, you know, well, who cares?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I hope so. Yeah.
Well, Cynthia, I think what you're saying is great. And you're right. Like, there's going to be aspects of everybody's lives, female or male, and, you know, different ages and so many things that you could consider and start to think, oh, I didn't get picked because of this or this. And what you said is, like, just do the best you can do. And I think also have a thick skin. Sometimes people are going to say things, or you hear about people saying things to other people, and just keep doing what you do. And that's probably the best. I think more often when there's like discrimination or any kind of gender issues in the music world, it's not usually direct. It's a lot of times indirect. And that makes it hard to detect and hard to really understand all the forces at play. Well, Cynthia, I wanted to say I got to hear you playing Scheherazade with Chicago Symphony this past February in Miami, which was awesome. Okay. It was a really wonderful performance, and I think everything in the percussion section was just spot on. So I wonder if you want to talk a little bit about what it's like to be on tour and to play, you know, sometimes different programs and different halls and, you know, kind of just different experiences everywhere.
No, so touring with the CSO is actually like a production in and of itself, as in we bring everything, like every single piece of equipment. We've even brought water depending on where we were going. Like, there's like stashes of water. No, touring's usually like really fun. I think for me, my very first tour ever with the Chicago Symphony was like 3 months after I started, and it was Bolero. So Bolero was on like every other day, and I didn't have tenure, and it was like a 2.5-3 week tour, and it was Bolero, Prokofiev Third Symphony. It was a lot of Three Cornered Hat, but I thought all tours were going to be that scary. So since then, every tour has been easier. So that's the good part. The thing about for us is we luckily or unluckily, we keep kind of going back to many of the same halls. So, and we don't really do sound checks anymore in most places. So the scariest bit is still just, you don't know how the stage sounds until the first note you play. And there's been tours where I only played encore. And so you go out there and it was some Rossini overture, and it starts with the snare drum, soft. And that's the encore. And I'd never played on the stage. And so you just kind of have to adjust like that quickly. But luckily now, most of the halls we've played on, so it's not as scary. I don't know. Touring is not a vacation. Touring gets tiring, even though I know like string players will be like, come on, you guys only play like half a program or blah, blah, blah. But still just, you know, being out of your routine and traveling and stuff like that. I don't know. I'm quite used to it, but I do see, like, to me, concerts on tour are even more important because we're representing us. Whereas, you know, people have expectations. And you definitely always want to exceed them and not disappoint them. So to me, you have to just always bring your A game for every single tour concert. And that's like kind of sometimes hard to sustain so in Florida, we had just come back from a 3 week Asia tour, like 2 weeks before we went to Florida.
Wow.
So we were kind of on fumes. Yeah.
I can imagine. You know, Cynthia, we have another Facebook question. This one is from Edward Choi.
Okay.
What are some of the most challenging pieces you've had to play in the orchestra?
Oh, Ed. I am so bad with names and pieces and memory, but the challenging pieces are actually the ones, not the ones with a lot of percussion. It's like the, Ed, I have no idea. They're all hard in their own right.
Tracy, let's hear one. Confession.
Confession of hardest pieces?
Yeah, let's have it.
I think the ones where you have to sit there for a really, really long time and then stand up and play your one triangle note or your one cymbal note are the hardest for me.
There was some, there's some Bruckner symphony.
Bruckner 7. I played it last month.
Or
oh, cool. Oh, I love it was some Bruckner symphony, and I was just playing it, this in school, but I remember, you know, of course, you're resting forever, and the blocks of rest were, I think they were in 10 bar chunks.
Oh, I hate when they have
so you couldn't, yeah, you could never, in rehearsals you were lost because you couldn't find where you were quick enough, and it was just really hard to follow because every moment where you would correspond like a new chunk with a new section of music was in the middle of a 10 bar or whatever, and yeah, that was just oh yeah, of course, that's just hell to try to,
you know, do. What's the hardest for me, this is total talk about confession,
let's have it.
Cut time. Anything and everything in cut time, super hard.
Huh.
Yeah, I will find myself like counting rests in cut time is a disaster for me. Because I'll just be like, 1, 2, 2, 2, 3, 2, 1, 2. Oh, no, why am I? What have we done? And
no,
it's
but
all off the rails.
Quarter note, cut time is hard because.
Yeah.
1, 2, 3, 4. No, 1 and 2 and. It's hard.
Well, it's weird. A lot of orchestra music and classical music, they use cut time, but the tempo is slow. Mm-hmm. Like band music and everything like, you know, yeah. Sousa Beyond. You know, cut time is fast. Like, why would you cut it in half unless the point was to move along? But yeah, I know what you mean. I looked at some piano score recently with a student, and it was in cut time, but it was super, super slow. And it's very interesting. And it did not feel in two at all. It was definitely in four. I mean, it was, yeah, it was,
I mean,
time signature was cut time, but it was definitely metered in four.
Some of my parts, the counting that I have to write in, literally 1 and 2 and.
Oh, it's good to hear you say that. It's good to hear. Students, listen to this.
Yeah.
Cut time is such a challenge. And like Jim gives me such a hard time because, I mean, his thing is, Cynthia, it's in two. My gosh.
Right.
Fast three gets me sometimes too. When you're like doing a three, but it's all in one. That one will get me at times also.
Oh, it's like there's a Beethoven scherzo, I guess, is it? It's Beethoven 9. It's in one, but it's in four bar phrases. So sometimes conductors will do it in four, even though it's measure 1, measure 2, measure 3, measure 4. And so, yeah, that's a little, yeah, not what we're used to.
Well, but that's why a lot of times I like, when I sit in Huntsville, a lot of times I like it when I get to play timpani because I get to play more. And so I'm more in tune with what's going on the whole time and stuff. It's a lot harder for me to sit there for a long time and then try to jump in.
See, writing in cues, I've gotten really good at.
Yeah.
Writing in cues, even if it's literally like when the horns turn the page. Yeah. Like, that is a cue in and of itself. You have a ton of rests. Like, because I also get lost counting rests, so a lot of my cues are, you know, key signature changes or certain notes, and then, you know, like people turning pages or like, you know, when, you know, there are themes that like reminds me of something else, and I'll just write that. It's like that theme when that comes in, that's there, and this note, and when they go like this, it's cues.
I've definitely read over the violin's shoulders a few times, like when we're set up right behind them. And then I also know that, like, oh, Terry stands up here or Sean stands up here. And so.
Yeah, but what happens when they get lost?
then we're all in trouble.
Well, see, luckily for us, Patsy, she's a good counter.
Yeah.
And then sometimes I'll just be like, guys, I need a cue. I always get lost.
See, that sounds fun to me.
Aww.
It does. It sounds fun. It's like, yeah, you have to go work with this, play with the same people over and over and over, like I was saying earlier.
I like it when I get to play with those guys. You know, it's nice to play. It is, like you said, nice to play with the same people fairly regularly. Yeah. So,
well, because you get through more layers. And there was someone in the podcast we were talking about. Oh man, who was it? I can picture her face. One of our guests, we were talking about small talk after a concert, and she was saying she receives it really well, like people saying, nice job, that was great, blah 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 blah. And I said, yeah, that's kind of always a not a drag for me, but I want to really get to know people, you know. And if you're always starting back at the first layer, it's, yeah, you never get to, I don't know, really learn anything, you know.
Yeah, but then orchestra is like family. You don't pick them. So
yeah.
You don't love every aunt and cousin.
Of course.
So, yeah. And you kind of see them. I mean, I definitely see my colleagues more than anybody else in this world.
Yeah, right. But then don't you just start, you know, then you just start harassing them, like you glue their mallet to the stand or, you know.
I have one colleague who turns my mallet. He plays the horn. He always takes one thing and turns it backwards. So sometimes I don't catch it. And then like one of your mallet is like the head is facing you.
My wife used to do that to Ben Toth all the time.
Oh, so really?
up at the Hart School, he's got a rack that sits above his desk that he has all of his mallets in, and they are so immaculately laid out in perfect order and everything. And so every time she would come up to school to visit, she would just plop one mallet into a different place just to see how long it took him to figure it out. And he would usually just come in, calmly look at it, move the mallet back, and then go on with his day.
Yeah.
Hey, well, we're kind of coming close to the end, but I think we have time for a couple more questions. Our regular co-host, Ben Charles. Ben Charles says, hi, Cynthia. Sorry I'm missing you today. I've enjoyed several of your performances with the CSO while I was a grad student at the University of Illinois, and I was absolutely blown away by you. 2 weeks in a row, I saw you perform the Rite of Spring bass drum excerpt. Then next week, I saw you give a phenomenal performance of the Bartok Concerto for two pianos, two percussion, and also Firebird Suite under Pierre Boulez. So his first question, he would love to know, what was it like working with the legend Pierre Boulez?
Oh, you know, I wish I was able to cherish it even more, because I was just scared shitless.
Right.
Like, I have such respect for the man. But, like, speaking of confessions, I didn't understand his music, but I could never ask him. Because I'm pretty sure I'm too dumb to understand his music. I mean, he was such a brilliant man, and I think the wavelength that he functioned at was not even human. So whenever he was like the sweetest little man. I loved him, and I'm really sad that we never, well, I guess, I mean, you don't know when the last time you'll ever see someone is, but just, yeah, I didn't get to cherish even more of it, because he did come to Chicago, and then he started having eye problems. And then the last time he was supposed to conduct the Holy Star, and he canceled because he couldn't see well. He didn't think he could see well enough, but he still flew in and was there because Christy Macellaro then took over and did all the rehearsals and concert. But Boulez was there the whole time, and that was really the last time he was ever in Chicago, the last time we ever saw him. But he was so humble and kind of a private man, but I really regret not spending more time and just like grew a pair and just talked to him and asked him questions, you know, because I was too scared. Yeah.
He's scary. I mean, I've only seen him in video, but man, he's scary in video.
Yeah, but he's the nicest, most gentle little soul you could ask for.
That's great. I've heard just incredible stories. People have worked with him saying, you know, we were doing this cluster chord of microtonal something, and he can hear, hey, you and this voice doing this right. microtone, you're sharp.
Yeah, he did. So back when I first started, he used to conduct some of the Music Now concert, our new music series, and I played on something of his, I think, and it was like one of those like 5/9 with like the, or 9/5 with like the third note missing and the seventh note missing. And, you know, like I fudged it the best I could. I mean, I did like write it out and like did the graph paper and then he was like, no, like this. And he would just conduct it with one hand and sing it with the other and do the other meter with the other hand. I mean, he was just cool. Like a freak show. And then he sang it and then he says, I have a cheat sheet. Let me give it to you. So he actually like gave me like his cheat sheet of like that one rhythm that he had figured out.
So what was on the cheat sheet?
It was something, and I have to go find it, but it was, I did it too literally. And also was like, I was on the front side of it. I was obviously nervous about it, and it was not meant to be that. But yeah, the man was amazing. I know, I gave him so when I got the job, like they invite you down to see the maestro, and he was standing in the hallway with the door open and his like arm out like this. And I thought he was gonna give me a hug. I'm a hugger when I'm excited. So I like went and like crushed him. And then there was no arm behind me. And then it was like a little pat, pat, pat. Oh, congratulations. But that was just a here, please come in gesture. But I took it as a hug and I almost killed him.
I thought you were gonna say you crushed him with a hug. And then later that day you said, my eye isn't working anymore.
No, but he, I mean, even back then, he was already, he felt really frail as I squeezed him.
Well, Ben Charles has one other question. He asks about how you did your bar talk, and we've talked about this on the podcast before, but your hi-hat muting contraption for two pianos, two percussion.
Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm so proud of that.
We had this great talk with John Tafoya, and God, we've talked about it. Long past on the show too, like how people deal with the snares on and off in the Bartok Sonata, and Ben talked about yours, how cool it is.
Yeah, you know, I really actually meant to patent it. Maybe I should do something about it. So I did this reverse. We have an amazing stage crew here, so they don't just like set up chairs and stands. Like when I need, like, oh, I kind of need this to do this, they come up with it. But the hi-hat thing, because I knew I wanted something to pedal, but I needed to work in it. Well, at first I thought I needed to work in reverse, but it didn't. It just like was like a piece of wood and there was like foam padding that was up. It was held up against the snare bed with rubber bands. And then it pulled like that pedal pulled it down, but there it took a lot of tweaking because you can't just foam because then it squeaks or there's like that sound, so then it had to be padded with like a hanky and it had to be just right. And then yeah, one of our guys built it for me. Yeah, because I think originally it was a plank of wood with a rope attached to it that was the pedal, and Joe was like, Cynthia, no. We can rig something up much better. I think that's how I did it when I did it in school. I just did like a piece of rope and like I taped a plank of wood to the ground as a pedal. And it's not cool.
Hey, so I just wanted to mention something I forgot on a topic back on Bob McCormick's episode. I was reporting on the tape machine that Edgar Varese was sent that he helped use on his famous poem Electronique. And I mentioned that Verez was suffering from a long depression of writer's block, which he only recovered from when someone anonymously sent him an Ampex tape recorder. Ampex is the company. And this, of course, leads Verez into this whole new compositional exploration of possibilities and sounds, and, of course, the ability to have music played right back to him that he was creating, so on and so forth. But I spoke a lot about the company itself and some resources on this history of electronic tape, and I mentioned Bing Crosby, the famous Bing Crosby dancer, singer, sent the Ampex company a no strings attached check for $50,000 to produce these tape machines. So that was before Verez was sent one, so it's kind of cool slash funny to think of the possibility that we might have Bing Crosby to thank for Verez getting out of this funk and for Verez's final works and pulling him out of his creative hiatus. So the little fun fact that I forgot to mention is that Bing Crosby at the time was currently under contract negotiations with his network broadcasters, those being CBS and NBC. He had a very popular musical variety show called The Bing Crosby Show, which was a radio show. And like all radio shows at the time, these were broadcasted and performed live. So Crosby, like everyone else who saw these Ampex tape machines, was really impressed for, of course, the sound replication fidelity, but he was particularly impressed and interested in their ability to edit. So these tape machines, of course, can splice and tape and move around, and they can record and edit. So his thinking was that he'd be able to pre-record and edit his shows rather than do them live. Thus, he could record an entire month's worth of shows in 1 week and supposedly play golf for the rest of the month. ABC was not interested in this, as they thought a pre-recorded show that wasn't live would not be something the public would accept, because it, I guess, hadn't been done yet, or at least wasn't common yet. So the chronology of the events here is, I think, really cool. The Ampex company creates and demos this tape recorder machine. Bing Crosby and his producers are very interested in the quality of it and the prospect of him having more time to record the shows whenever he wants and not have to do it on the broadcaster's schedule, but on his own time. The company does not have enough money to support the demand and the production of these machines. Crosby gives them this $50,000 check, and then the tape recorders are produced and purchased by all the major networks and utilized and become kind of industry standard for at least about a decade or so. And the company continues to develop smaller and cheaper machines. And years later, one of these machines is what will be sent to Verez. So it was just a fun fact that I forgot to include in there. That was actually in my notes, but we got sidetracked or something, and I somehow missed it. So when you look up the history of recorded tape, Bing Crosby has that like one little note in there that he's interested in this technology because he doesn't want to have to keep doing live recorded broadcasts.
That's fascinating.
I thought it was fascinating and fun. I have one review question for you all that is sort of on the same lines. It's kind of fun when, you know, one of our composers, who of course is probably not that generally known to the public, has a relationship with someone as famous as Bing Crosby or is very, very known to the public. So one little review question for you. And Tracy, Carly, yeah, just shout it out. Or, of course, Cynthia, shout it out if you know. But this was something I talked about way back on episode 134. And this question goes like this. So this famous rock band and composer, the composer Giacinto Scelsi, share a use of this very uncommon monophonic electronic keyboard instrument. This instrument's settings allowed it to electronically imitate different instruments of the orchestra, but Scelsi was known to use it primarily for its pitch bending and microtonal abilities. Musicians in the U.S. in the 40s and 50s know this instrument to be called the clavillin, but for Scelsi in Italy, it was called the andolia. So what very famous band also used this very odd electronic instrument?
I've got nothing.
Crickets.
Just give it a guess, Tracy.
Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention?
Oh man, that's a really good guess. And actually, I wouldn't be surprised at all if we can find Frank Zappa messing around with this. It happens to be the Beatles, and I had to ask this today because you know,
really?
Because Ben's gone, and he loves the Beatles, and he would definitely have remembered that. And it's on their song "Baby, You're a Rich Man." There's this little solo with the clavulin or andolia instrument that's in there. So it's kind of cool that, I don't know, when you see these connections, like, hey, Bing Crosby, who I'm sure like didn't know Verez, I assume, and I can't imagine Verez had a ton of interest in Bing Crosby, but it's because of those two things happening in separate places that this cool thing happened on the classical side of things. So likewise with the Beatles and Chelsea.
Yeah.
Well, anywho, man, Cynthia, yay, thanks so much for...
Thank you for having me.
You know, answering a cold call and reaching out and letting me reach out to you and do this.
It was my pleasure. Thank you so much.
Cool, cool. All right, everyone, we'll catch you on 184. Tracy and Carly, thanks so much. You guys are awesome as always.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys.
All right, bye, everyone.